So I am delighted to welcome today Professor Stuart Heck from the theater department here. He's associate professor in the theater department at Boston College, where he teaches and directs after spending 13 years as the department chair. So you've paid your penance. Now you can be free. His book, Transposing Broadway, Jews, Assimilation, and the American Musical, was published last November by Palgrave Macmillan Press. He's a longstanding editor of New England Theater Journal and has published many articles there and elsewhere on theater history. Professor Hecht has long been an officer for the American Theater and Drama Society. He's a member of the Chicago Theater Symposium and also the New England Theater Conference's College of Fellows. He worked as a dramaturge for the Chicago's Goodman Theater, one of my favorite theaters in the country, and Wisdom Bridge Theater before moving to Boston to begin his academic career. His BA is from the University of Michigan and an MA and PhD from Northwestern University. And his presentation today is entitled American Dreams, Jews and Broadway. So thanks so much for being here with us.
Thank you, Eric, and thank you, Alan, and thanks to all of you for being here today. Goodness gracious, the American Musical. The American Musical has the reputation of being about jazz hands and chorus lines and legs, usually of the female persuasion, and razzmatazz and escapism. And all true. And yet, upon looking at it more closely, I discovered that there's a heck of a lot more going on. My research began with the idea that if you perform something on stage, in addition to entertaining an audience, you're also demonstrating something in the public setting. You're performing a dynamic that has to which the audience has to be able to relate and understand. And another bottom line feature of theater in general is the notion that playwrights, well, it's far too tough a way to make a living simply in the hopes that you're going to get a hit. And the fact of the matter is that what keeps most playwrights going is because they're trying to speak to the times. They're trying to say to the collective audience, which is a microcosm of the larger community, these are the issues of the day, which might be social, they might be political, they might be psychological, and above all, I think, ethical. Is this how one lives one's life? Is this the best way in which we do things? And ultimately, the word entertain takes on a different meaning. Rather than escapism, perhaps entertain means holding one's attention. The image I give is of Susie, and she's just waiting for her guy, Tim, to pick her up on her date. She's not ready yet. Tim's downstairs, so she turns to her little brother, Johnny, and says, Johnny, can you go downstairs and entertain Tim for a few minutes while I prepare myself? Do you think that little Johnny actually puts on a straw hat, gets a cane, and does five verses from Chorus Line? What it means is holding one's attention, and that means engaging one's mind. In looking at the past 100 years, the growth of the American musical, in particular, has become a hallmark both nationally and internationally. It's one of the identifiers for this country and its culture. It's one of our biggest exports about American life. And it's a multi-billion dollar industry. And yet, where did it come from and why? The form has roots back in 19th century vaudeville. The form has roots in European popular entertainments called operettas. And it was really took more of a shape in terms of storytelling thanks to a group of Irishmen. So it's fitting we're at Boston College. Mostly George M. Cohan of Give My Regards to Broadway fame. And also a guy you may not know so much about named Victor Herbert. You know about Victor Herbert? He wrote things like Babes in Toyland, fanciful things, again, operatic, classical. And they sort of laid the groundwork. But this is happening with why Irishmen in America? And why am I talking about Jews in America? Because really what we're talking about is how this form corresponds and its roots correspond to the big migrations of the 19th century in general. Irish in the 1840s. Large groups later on, including Jews and Italians, starting in the 1880s. Moving mostly to New York. And of course, this is a New York form for a New York audience. And when peoples came from other countries, for the most part, they settled into their own little neighborhoods with their own ethnicities, sometimes not even never learning to speak English. And yet, their children wanted to. They learned on the street. Even if mom and dad didn't want them to, that's what they wanted. It's natural. It's a social phenomenon. So, my fascination came with what's the correlation between this process of Americanization on one hand and the parallel evolution of this form on the other hand, because they do go hand in hand, they do correspond. In fact, early on when I started talking about musicals and Broadway and I was trying to find images for it, I said, you know, it's fascinating, but I really believe that the American musical functions as what I call America's cultural Ellis Island. So Ellis Island, of course, the place where many immigrants, I think it was open to what, was it 1892, I think, before it was Castle Island, I think. But regardless, Ellis Island. The place where, which was the gateway into America, the place where your name might get changed, the gateway where you had to be healthy enough, and if you weren't, you were turned aside because there were gatekeepers. And if you were acceptable, you were somehow magically transformed in the process. And I say culturally because it is a process of transformation. America is the hyphenated nation. It's a nation where everybody... I mean, you could even argue Native Americans, I think, comes from a different place at some point. And more specifically, I'm looking at the influx of Jews to America. And why Jews? Hi. Well, for a bunch of reasons. One, because they've increasingly formed an increasing percentage of the New York theater-going audience. They dominated the Broadway audience starting in the 1920s on to the present, you know. Huge percentage of the musicians' union. And every single major composer slash lyricist slash librettist, meaning the person who writes the books, with the exception of Cole Porter, was Jewish. Every single one of them. Their parents loved ethnic theater. In New York, there were something like 12 different Yiddish vaudeville houses operating, in addition to, about the same number of Yiddish theaters, which favored over-the-top melodramas, over-the-top acting. You know, think Jim Carrey, but serious. With music. And the Jewish population flocked to these theaters. And a lot of these composers were there as children. The other side of this is that most of these composers' parents, fathers, an unbelievably large percentage of them were cantors. So they were raised with liturgy and the musical liturgy that sometimes crept into the stuff that they wrote themselves. For example, on Monday, I'm teaching West Side Story. And originally, it was called East Side Story. And it was supposed to be about the battles between neighborhood Jews and Irish in the east side of New York. But then what happened was that Leonard Bernstein married Alicia, who was from South America, and he wanted to do that kind of music. And also the Puerto Rican population on the west side was growing, so let's change it, you know. But you can still hear the echoes, for example. If you listen to the opening music of the show, if you know it, it starts off very creepy. Da-dum, 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 right? But you know what that is? That's the introduction of the Irish gang. How do you know that? Because all of a sudden we have a different kind of music that's introduced. Da-da-da-dum, da-da-da-dum. And it says, if you look at the music of the score, it says, enter so-and-so, right? You know who that would be? Which gang? That's the Jewish gang. You know why? That's called tequila. That's a chauffeur blow from the High Holidays. Da-da, young. So Leonard Bernstein's using this directly. And others did too. George Gershwin, his most important piece in terms of modern music, really, was his Rhapsody in Blue. That's what made jazz respectable. And it starts off with a klezmer clarinet. Oh, that's jazz. You see? So it is being fed through that side. But it's being fed in a more profound way through the nature in which the shows themselves and the way they were written. So let me try and explain one of my fundamental arguments, and then I can open up this to everybody for questions and comments and so on. The goal was the American dream, wasn't it? It still is. Come to America. And now you're starting to have, at conferences, the question, does the American dream still exist? Does it still work? But it's still the topic. It's still what we're concerned about. It's the thing that unites us. It's the thing that brings people to America. It's still about our aspirations, hopes, and dreams. And the question is, can you achieve the American dream if you stay as ethnic as your parents were? And the answer is no. No. And this is an ongoing discussion about who is American, isn't it? Even to this day. And we still have these conversations about, should English be required, for example. It's still flying around, isn't it? But in the early 19th century, it was not a question. This was a given. People are going to learn English. As I said, the children want to. Well, why? I want to assimilate. Well, I want to fit into the kids, right? I don't want to be a greenhorn, right? But at the same time, the larger issue is wanting to... After you find your friends in the schoolyard, then what happens is then it becomes a formula for success. And the big question is one of negotiation. To what degree must one transform him or herself to the dominant culture in order to gain acceptance, and more than that, to achieve the American dream, which is what? Upward mobility, financial success, and acceptance. I mean, doesn't America promise opportunity? Isn't that what opportunity means? That your past can be erased in a funny way? Or not erased, or does it need to be erased? Maybe it's okay to have your past, but maybe it doesn't matter. But on the other hand, what do we wear if we're going to a job interview? Even now. What you're going to wear if you're amongst your pals? You see? We still do it. So we're talking about the relationship between assimilation as a contract to achieve the American dream, and to what degree does someone have to do that or not. Now, in terms of Jews, this is complex because for a bunch of reasons. First of all, who is a Jew? Is someone Jewish because of religious affiliations? You know? Maybe. Or is someone Jewish because of blood or DNA? Or is someone Jewish because their mother was Jewish? Someone could be any of those things. Even if you're religious, well, okay, are you Orthodox? Are you conservative? Are you Reconstructionist? Are you Reform? even if you're Orthodox. Are you Lubavitch? Or if you go to Israel and they say, well, we're going to decide if you're Jewish enough to be here. And even if you're not religious at all, you can say you're Jewish because you're going to define yourself as part of the tribe or your family. You could be a complete agnostic and still say you're Jew. And that's okay. Or you're a socialist. Lots of Jews became socialists. Some even became, communists. But still, they would view themselves as Jews. But I have also friends who are socialists who, if I mention something Jewish, they get upset with me. Because this is America. You can be who you want to be. And Werner Soller's wonderful book, you know, Ascent and Descent. To what degree is this by tradition or blood, or to what degree in America do you have a choice to be who you want to be? And you have a right to invent yourself. Very fundamental here. So anyway, basically, here's kind of the scoop then. Starting about 1912, you have musicals that are, musicals are starting to be changed. In a sense, the musical, we're used to two kinds of musicals, all right? One are what are called book musicals, which would be what? Like Oklahoma, telling a story. Gee, what's going to happen to Laurie and Curly? And there's another kind of musical, which is a review, which basically may well be just a collection of songs. Mamma Mia. Right? There's sort of a plot, but not really. And even then, you don't need one. Okay? Right? Yeah. Okay. So.
Don't remember ABBA.
Hello. Well, you don't realize this, but at the end of my talk, I'm expecting everybody to get on the table and do three choruses of Dancing Queen. Right? But the thing, so when we're talking about all this stuff, you know, we're talking about taking a form that was really reviews, okay, up until about 1910. In fact, of course, it still is today. You can still see it, but I'm saying it is the predominant form. And you start to have Jewish composers who are Americanized. They're mostly, I call it second generation. Some people call it first generation, but I'm going to use second generation because that's my terminology. So I'm saying the first generation are the immigrants themselves, second generation being their children, okay? And basically saying that their children, therefore, have been Americanized. They've gone through at least the New York public school system, which is actually very sophisticated in that era. And some of them even gone to college. The school of choice in New York was actually Columbia for a lot of these people. Anyway, and in Chicago, like my mom's from Chicago, they would say, oh yeah, where'd you go to school? I went to Chicago University. Right? Yeah. So, yeah. It's like in Detroit, they referred to working. I worked at Ford's. Yeah, so before, it's like your family, you know. Anyway, here's the story. The story is that about 1912, you start having Jerome Kern, who's the first great, I mean, you also have Irving Berlin, but he's not part of our story right now. That's a whole other chapter, literally. Read the book. It's wonderful. It's brilliant. I even have lyrics. You can sing along. But Kern becomes really interested in saying, instead of the musical being about, you know, showgirls and huge spectacle and all this stuff, maybe it could be about everyday Americans living sort of normal lives. Well, he had to. He didn't have much money. They had small budgets. But also, he was really into this. He was just saying, maybe music themselves could be more about those people themselves. That's a radical thought. So he starts doing some shows. They're called the Princess Shows. Sitting in the balcony watching the shows is this, at that point, about 11-year-old young man by the name of Richard Rodgers, the same one who would later team up with Hart and then Hammerstein. And he says, and Kern became his god. And that's really important because Rodgers is going to take this, take the baton and run even farther with it. But the point is that the form starts to change, and by the late 1920s, it takes some major strides. And another, and Rodgers did go to Columbia, and Lawrence Hart went to Columbia, and another upperclassman was a guy named Oscar Hammerstein at Columbia. They all knew each other when they were like 15 years old. So be careful who you knew. But what happened was that Oscar Hammer, they all had the same image in their mind, which is about, let's make the form about real life. And let's make the form about expressing our experience in America somehow. So, putting all these pieces together now, okay? So you've got the vaudeville strand, we've got the operetta strand, right? But there's another element here. Look at many Shakespeare plays. Shakespeare often had secondary or tertiary characters, plot lines. So he would have something like Hamlet, right? And of course, Queen Elizabeth is up there, you know. He's talking about God and government, you know. But who else is there? People who paid only a penny. And they want some, you know, crude and rude entertainment. Think Avenue Q. Okay? So therefore he puts the gravediggers in there, making horribly bad jokes. Well, you know, also with skulls. Right? Well, the point, reason they did that was because they had two different kinds of audience. They entertained everybody. And this became a standard form. And you get this in especially English literary or dramatic traditions. Gilbert and Sullivan used it too in a lot of their material, operettas. And that was the other hero for these people. So, okay, so we got the operetta, we got the, you know, Ravel. And here's basically what happened. Hammerstein did this. He started to write not just the lyrics, but the books, the stories. And the stories themselves would feature double couples. The primary couple, okay, would be our romantic leads. They would be good-looking in a wasp sense. Did I mention wasp? Yes, they should be wasp, right? They should be romantic because ultimately it's going to be about marriage. Very serious, right? All those, yeah. And the music they sang was semi-classical, which is to say it's coming from that European semi-classical operetta tradition. And then I argue, this is me, that what happens is a secondary couple. And the secondary couple are of all shapes and sizes, are comedic, right? It's not about romance, they're about sex. Yeah, I know, right? And they're ethnic. And the music they sing and the forms they sing against are from vaudeville, popular American culture. So if you look at something like Oklahoma, for example, you have the primary couple, which would be Curly and Lori. And she sings things like, oh, good Lord. Many a new day, dun, 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 dun. I mean, my God, it's like opera. Mm-hmm. Try to sing that stuff, you know? It's an operetta. You know, but you have secondary couples, like Ado, Annie, and Will, who sing something like, everything's up to date in Kansas City, the Conobot's fur, which is pure vaudeville. Even does a little buck and wing to it. Yes, he's in cowboy boots, but nevertheless. Okay? So you can see that the form starts to play itself out. You see it in 1924 with Desert Song, which is a Hammerstein show. You see it in 1927 with Showboat. Okay? You start to see similar stuff being tinkered with Rogers and his first writing partner, Larry Hart. And you start to see it especially by 1943 when Oklahoma comes in, which is the first. That was in the first book musical, but it became so successful that nobody could write any other kind of show for 25 years. So that's, and even today, right? So that's what's going on. The audience, again, is mostly Jewish. So these are Jewish composers speaking of their experience, right, as adjusting to American life, and they're getting more successful, aren't they? So they're becoming upwardly mobile. They're starting to achieve the American dream. And these sensibilities, and that means what? Not just having money, it also means knowing the difference between Keats and Tennyson. Between, Beethoven and Brahms. Which is to say, refinement. Cultural refinement becomes the hallmark of the upper class. Largely because the immigrants were moving into the cities and taking over the political clout. So they had to do something. So you start seeing these shows about. So there's two patterns. One is upward mobility. So you see it in things like, well, Rogers and Hart in 1936 do a show called On Your Toes, right? And what's it about? Well, one of the leading lady is a ballerina on her toes. And they bring in not just someone to teach them tap dance, and not just anybody, right? They bring Georges Balanchine in to choreograph ballet for this show. With a Russian accent, no doubt. And then he follows that, because later on you get something like South Pacific, where he brings in Izzy Opinza, who is a big star of the Metropolitan Opera. we have to have opera on our shows. And he writes music, the opening to Carousel. He writes music that's semi-classical. We're upwardly mobile. We're becoming refined. We're making it, which is the epitome of assimilation. In a, at the same time, what starts to happen with these double couples is at the very beginning, like in these 1910 shows, the 20 shows, like in Desert Song, the secondary couple. Well, the primary couple, one is a member of the French Foreign Legion. Think Rudolph Valentino, you know, the chic, right? You know, of course, they're really Americans. We all know that, but they'll be cool this way. In Morocco, battling the reefs, you know. But the secondary couple, therefore, is Susan and Benny, who are British. Benny, think early Bob Hope, that sort of like, you know, coward comedy. That's Benny, with a British accent. But he's British, he's different, you see, he's an outsider. So he's ecumenic. And they're supposedly trying to have sex, but we don't really know how successful they are, but okay, it's fine. Okay? But by the time you get to Oklahoma, the ethnicity is starting to pour in a little bit. So, for example, you have a peddler in Oklahoma named Ali Hakim, a Persian peddler. Now, I don't know about you, but when I think about peddlers in the American West, I don't think Persian.
He's a Persian Jew.
Yeah. Well, there you go, right? You know? It's Jewish. And you say, well, gee, Stuart, how come you know he's Jewish? Because they cast Joseph Bulloff in the role. Who's Joseph Bulloff? Joseph Bulloff was a huge star of the Yiddish theater in New York. So the American, the New York audience is going, yeah, it's Ali Hakim, but guess what? Who's playing it, you know? They knew. You know? And it's fascinating because what basically happens in that show is that he gets caught in a shotgun wedding, right? I mean, okay, you have the two secondary couples. You have Judd and you have Ali Hakim, right? And Judd is a threat to the primary couple, and Ali Hakim is a threat to the comedy couple. And it's really interesting because Judd, right, good old American Judd, might be a mass murderer, we're not sure. He actually is. There's hints of it in Green Grove the Lilacs that he actually is. It's really kind of creepy stuff. But, you know, but he's Wasp. That's okay. You know, they're serious, they're going to get married. They deserve someone who will kill them. And then you've got Ali Hakim, and he's a threat to what? Ado, Annie, and to Will, whose big problem is that she can't say no. And what's his crime? What's his danger? His danger is he's promiscuous. And almost takes her away almost from Will. But in the end, he gets his due. I mean, Judd gets his due. He gets killed. And he gets his due. He gets in a shotgun marriage with Gertie, who's the most obnoxious thing you ever heard, because all she does is giggle like a goat. And but what's interesting is he survives because he's comedic. And also, he's welcome into the community. And that's huge. That's a huge cultural shift. And this is 1943. This is the height of World War II. So we see a transition happening here. This transition is going to continue. Certain hallmarks, 1950, you'll see Guys and Dolls. Again, primary couples, Skye Masterson and Sister Sarah Brown of the Salvation Army. And he's Skye Masterson. Hello. Who gets all the gamblers to go into a celestial bet, which they lose. But all the gamblers, especially the major one, is what? Nate in Detroit and Adelaide, you know? And they're Jewish. You say, well, how do you know that, Stuart? Well, because sue me, why do you do me? No. Right? Right? There it is, right? Right? Need me, right? 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 There it is, right?
All the best years of my life.
Not about it. You're just a good, no good Nick, right? Right, right. It's all there, you know. But this is, oh, it's wonderful, right? Yeah. So you know, you're sitting there going, oh my God, you know, and you know, and the funny thing about Adelaide also is kind of intriguing is that up until now, if you have like, you've got an Ali Hakim, you know, but he's still kind of two-dimensional. Adelaide sort of is. But on the other hand, she's also neurotic. Do anybody remember what it is that her problem is?
She gets a cold.
Right. A poison could develop a cold.
The average married female.
Right? Isn't it wonderful?
It's just a long frustration.
Right, right, right. Dun, 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 dun.
With
but
But this indicates that she has some depth to her, too. Mm-hmm. Paradoxically. It's funny. But, you know?
She's reading the footnotes.
She's a scholar. So, right? But here's the deal. At the very end, where do they end up? So you've got the ethnic gangsters, and then you've got the Salvation Army. And then they have a bet. They lose the bet. Where they have to go? They have to go to the Salvation Army's headquarters, barracks, where there's a big revival meeting. And what happens? They all convert. And once they convert, suddenly Adeline and Nathan can get married. Because now they're all WASP. They're accepted into the community, but on different terms. This is written by Frank Lesser, by the way, and Abe Burrows, who were both Jews. So, although it's based on stories by Damon Runyon, who wasn't, I don't know. But it's interesting, because that was the terms by 1950, even post-World War II. Then what happens? You have HUAC, right? Everybody's terrified to be anything except straight-laced American, right? It's holy assimilation, Batman, right? You have to, the straight and narrow, you see shows developing, they're still doing this stuff, except they're not ethnicized now. So two big hits, for example, would be like Pajama Game and Music Man. And in Pajama Game, you have the protagonist. He's Russian. Not Jewish, he's Russian. But he's in this town. He's from Chicago. And everybody talks about him as he's an outsider to this town. He's an outsider. And he's the one that solves everything. Because they're really funky anyway. Pajama Game is just a weird story. But he solves everything. He makes everything right. And the other show, and it's in Iowa, and the other show, which is also in Iowa, is Music Man. And who's Harold Hill? An outsider. And they're all like, oh, we're living our lives, and nobody's happy. Everybody's miserable in River City. That's the song they don't sing. Right here with a capital M for misery, you know. But what happens is he comes along and he brings life and vitality and energy and culture, which is like a Broadway show, to an otherwise placid, stale, sterile America. See what I'm saying? And as Alan pointed out, which I missed, and he was absolutely right, he falls in love with a librarian who doesn't fit in because she's a bookworm. Guys, come on, take heart. Yeah. But who is her mother? She's Irish. So they're ethnic outsiders too. Isn't that interesting? So that's the early 50s. By the late 50s, we're moving to JFK. We can have ethnic in the White House, right? You're starting to see more ethnic characters. But what's happened really cool is this. Remember, now we said ethnic characters only be sex and silly and don't take them seriously. They're getting a little more prominent, right? By the late 50s, they're starting to become leads. Because their audience is starting to make it. They're accepted within the mainstream norm. See what happens? So you get a show like Fiorello LaGuardia. What could be more New York than that? You know?
And you're also Jewish.
And Italian, I think?
Was Jewish.
Yeah.
He was half Jewish. Italian
and
Jewish.
And then Tom Bosley. I mean, there's a song in there where there's a yeah. You're absolutely right. There was a song in the show though. Did you ever see Happy Days, the TV show?
Oh yeah.
The father was Tom Bosley. Uh-huh. His first major role was playing Fiorello LaGuardia in Fiorello on Broadway, for which they won the Pulitzer Prize. So he has a song in the show where he sings like he sings a song that's in Yiddish and in Slovakia. I mean, it's like five different languages because he's running for office in New York City. But that's a wonderful statement because all of a sudden ethnicity is not hidden. You see? Suddenly it's out in the open. It's okay. And then, of course, the pinnacle of all, I mean, at 64 you have two shows that are really important. One is Funny Girl. So you've got Fanny Bryce. We even have scenes in Henry Street, for God's sake, on the Lower East Side. At her parents, her mother's bar with all these Yiddish, Jewish friends and everything quelling over her. Right? And then you get also, but Fiddler. And Fiddler is huge. Because, again, not only do we, for a bunch of reasons, well, I'll mention it briefly, but basically Fiddler is huge for a bunch of reasons. One is that now there's nobody, listen, they're romantic, they're all the leads, right? They're serious. Even Fanny Bryce, is sometimes clownish, but then there's the moments with Nikki Arnstein, where it becomes serious. And she has feelings. And then it becomes how she breaks, you know, the what do you call it? Pagliacci, you know, it's like the clown with tears kind of thing. With her. And Nicky Anstey, by the way, was much more of a jerk than he showed in that show, but the problem was he was alive at the time. And they had to get the rights. It's true. Ray Stark was a producer. It's wonderful. Movie Sharif was wonderful, wasn't he? Yeah. But yeah, Ray Stark was the producer for the whole production, and he was actually he was married to Bryce's daughter. So it's just like woo. Anyway, but Philly's really important because, again, they play primary characters that are now serious or romantic, but there's something really, really different about Philly that never happened before, and that's very, very much this. All these other shows, we're talking about what? We're talking about Jews who are trying to assimilate into America, right? That's what it's all about. Fiddler ain't in America. We're in Russia, or the Pale. And what we see is a world, instead of saying, here is a secular world, and how can outsiders fit into that, right? And we, the audience, of course, represent that secular world, even if there's a large percentage that are Jewish. Because, of course, these shows are also going all over the country, right? I mean, you can see your production of Fiddler, of Funny Girl in Boise, Idaho. You know, everybody's seeing this stuff. But the other side is, in Fiddler, we are the outsiders. What's presented on stage is a world unto itself. And there are non-ethnic people in the form of the Cossacks, you know, but we don't see them except occasionally they'll wander in, oh, for little things like a pogrom. It's horrible, you know. And so for the first time, it's saying this is an acceptable norm in its own terms. Now that's really fascinating, isn't it? Because what it means is that American, these people, and this is an experience shared by lots of people, so don't get me wrong, but I'm focusing on the Jews right now. But that, you know, it's like we're sufficiently American, and we feel sufficiently safe in America now, right? That we can now not have to be ethnic, but not have to be American anymore. We can show our ethnicity now. Do you see what I'm saying? And of course, it doesn't hurt that it ends up being a brilliant show that becomes the longest running hit on Broadway for like a couple generations and is exported over the world. I came across a YouTube video of a bunch of Japanese doing a community theater production of Fiddler, which was really weird.
In Japanese.
Oh, it was just surreal. But it works, and it's because people relate to it, largely because of the song tradition, which made it universal, you know. But then you say, okay, Fiddler's... I have a chapter book called Fiddler's Children, because I'm saying, okay, so what did this do? It made the musical, this form invented by Jews, largely to say, how do you become American? Because that's what they're doing. They're showing, guess what? Here's what Nathan Detroit did. That's what I get to have to do too, right? What Adelaide did, huh? Yeah. It's a blueprint. It's a template. How do you become American? And also, because it's being shown in Boise, Idaho, it's showing America how to be inclusive. Let's project an image of America that isn't just simply small town, all WASPs in the middle of Iowa. Let's show America that's inclusive, which is what Hollywood was also doing. Right? That part of it. But then you get the children. What I mean by that is, Jews use it, it worked. And they still do. But guess what? Then you start having other groups use it. See, in the 60s into the 70s, you get shows. And I mean, this is not arbitrary, guys. I actually chart exactly who and why and how. But for example, like Hair, which is showing another fringe group that wants in as its own community. And we're introduced to the community, just like we were Fiddler. And later, Rent, same thing. See? And other variations, for example, and frankly right now, Book of Mormon. Okay? And then you have other variations, and then you have women's shows. And you have gay shows, right? You have black shows. You have In the Heights, which is a Dominican community in the upper West Side of New York. And if you saw the production, you look in the program, what, I'm blanking his name, so stupid, Len, this is so stupid, I have no brain cells left. The guy that developed and he starred in it. But he says in the program notes, he says, oh yeah, two favorite shows growing up, and one of them was Fiddler on the Roof. And that's why. And where are we? We're not just like downtown, and here's like in West Side Story. We're sort of in America, and here's the Puerto Rican gang. Okay? Versus the Americans? That would be 1956 version. In the Heights? No. We are in Washington Heights. We're in the middle of the Dominican community. We're on that street, and this is the bodega, and this is, you know. And we see it, which is just like, and Color Purple, same thing. I matched up Color Purple almost perfectly against Fiddler on the Roof. It's the same kind of characters, the same kind of settings, same references to the old country, if it were, you know. And it fits like a glove. So what happened is they invent the Jewish, in the effort to help their own people adjust to America, they've created this basically, this I call cultural Ellis Island, which explained how any peoples, if they follow this magic formula, can gain access to the American mainstream with an eye toward achieving, hopefully, the American dream. And yes, even with jazz hands. So I'm going to stop there, because... And that's just a couple chapters.
Oh, terrific. Thank you so much.